This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Dave Brown, and this is a podcast version of AMI's Morning Show, now with Dave Brown. Catch the live broadcasts weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Let's turn our attention to the environment. British Columbia's Forests Minister has introduced a bill to amend the Forest and Range Practices Act, saying it would reshape forest management in the province. Katrine Conroy told the legislature the proposed changes are long overdue and include a greater focus on the health of forests and ecosystems.
Forest policies that were put in place nearly two decades ago, they have limited our ability to fight climate change, to protect old-growth forests, and to share the benefits with Indigenous and local communities. Past policies left much control of the forest operations in the hands of the private sector. It's time for government to manage forests for British Columbians.
Conroy says the changes would align key forestry legislation with the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and the province will work in partnership with Indigenous nations and land management decisions within their territories. For his thoughts on the forest industry and its impact, we're joined by environmental contributor Lawrence Gunther. Lawrence is also the host of Outdoors with Lawrence Gunther. You can catch that show Sundays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio, or you can download the podcast on your favorite podcasting platform. Hey, good morning, Lawrence.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm well. Nice to chat with you once again. So, Lawrence, let's talk about the economic side of the forest industry first. From an economic perspective, how valuable is the forestry industry?
It's about $26 billion of our GDP. It contributes about $1.9 billion to taxes into their provinces and territories who control, you know, the stumpage fee. You hear about stumpage fees, so that's how much governments lease out the land, their crown land, for. So they get about $1.9 billion. And in terms of exports, Dave, it's about $33 billion of exports. You know, a lot of it going to the United States, a lot of it to Asia, all over the world. In real terms, though, like if you think about northwestern Ontario, right, like Thunder Bay and all that whole area, if you look at forestry and mining, the tourism industry up there, like fishing and hunting and camping and adventuring in the outdoors, it's worth more than forestry and mining combined in northwestern Ontario. So, you know, just to give it some perspective. So it's important to Canada, but there's other things that are more important that have to do with our resources and nature.
Right, and people may be appreciating the beauty and the value of those ecosystems. So then we get to the flip side. Mm-hmm. What are the ecological concerns of cutting down things like forests and especially old growth forests?
Well, you know, for most of southern Canada, we've been doing forestry for 300 years. Like, so there's no old growth left in most of southern Canada. You know, in Ontario, southern Ontario, we're logging third generation logs. Like even Algonquin Park now, that's all second generation growth, right? So there's nothing old growth in Algonquin Park and nowhere in Ontario, nowhere across southern Canada. But on a positive note, there's now more trees in southern Ontario than there was 100 years ago. You know, 100 years ago in the 1920s and 30s, farmers were cutting everything down and putting everything to the plow. And then they realized, wow, man, we've got the Dust Bowl happening and the Depression and everything's blown away. Topsoil is blown away. And more though, you know, people with small plots of land, instead of, you know, having a 50-acre farm, they've reforested it and they're growing trees. So there's just a lot of trees being grown in southern Ontario.
Lawrence, let's talk about the land rights side of the conversation in forestry. Can you give us a bit more detail on the forest consultation and revenue sharing agreement and how that may play into land rights and decision making?
Well, you know, the big value thing in British Columbia is definitely the old growth trees, right? So how many of their old growth forest is there? The government of British Columbia says it's 24% of the forest there is still old growth. Naturalists, environmentalists would say only 1% is really old growth. They say about 13 million hectares is old growth. About 10 million of that is not economically viable. So the BC government considers old growth to be any tree older than 140 years old. But you can have trees that are 2,000 years old, 1,000 years old in British Columbia, and they're as thick as your arm. They're just growing in really, you know, desolate, inhospitable locations where they just don't grow fast at all. And they have no value. They're old, they're forests, they're trees, but from a forestry perspective, they have no value. So the real valuable trees are the old big ones, right? That the 2,000-year-old trees that would take you, you know, 10 minutes to walk around the trunk of, right? Mm. You know, six of us, Dave, could stand around one of these trees and join hands and we could barely reach around the tree. You know, that's how big these trees are. They're 350 feet tall. They're humongous trees. And this is what captures people's imagination. But at the same time, you know, we have 70 land claims being negotiated across Canada. We have a land back movement that's coming up now, and it's part of give back the land. 89% of the land in Canada is considered crown land. That means 11% is privately owned, but that 89% wasn't crown land until, you know, we, the settlers, decided it would be crown land. Before that, it was, you know, North America. Mm-hmm. And it was the land of the indigenous people. So they were saying, hey, you know what? We want our land back. Well, getting that done has taken a few paths. We have indigenous protected and conservation agreements that are being negotiated. We have the 30 by 30 initiative, which is going to put 30% of our land, 30% of our water, 30% of our oceans under protected status of some sort or another that's involving indigenous people now. And we have these forestry agreements that's saying, you know, okay, we haven't done a land claim with you, but we understand there's unceded land involved here that's being, you know, forested. It's, you know, we call it crown land. They call it indigenous land, traditional land. So there's this agreement now in BC to say, let's work together on how this is done. Now, a lot of people think that First Nations people are going to protect the land and guard the land and make it a natural, pristine sort of protected area. That's not necessarily the case. They're going to apply their values. They're going to look at everything they do on the land from seven generations down perspective. Like what would our great, 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 great grandchildren be looking at if we take this decision? And they're going to look at the land in terms of their right to utilize the land, which they always have, right? Mm-hmm. They've always utilized the land to trade, to harvest, to sustain themselves, to, you know, gain riches, to, you know, for trading and so forth. So they're not going to stop doing that. They just want to have a chance to make a living. And the moderate livelihood thing we hear about, they mm-hmm. won the court case for that, for fisheries. They want to have a chance to make a living, and they want to apply their values in how that's done. So this is the government of British Columbia saying, we're going to pass you this hot potato because we can't seem to win with the environmentalists on this. You know, if we say, yes, there's forestry jobs, and we're cutting down trees, people get upset. So let's let the First Nations communities wrestle with some of these more politically hot potato type questions. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, what we have with Fairy Creek now, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have these 2,000 trees being harvested.
Lawrence, we really appreciate your thoughts and perspective on this issue, but let's shift gears here a little bit because you were involved in a really neat project called Artificial Divide. This is a collection of short stories that includes something that you wrote called Getting Back Alive. So Lawrence, give us a few more details on this project in broad strokes and how you got involved.
I don't know. I read somewhere, you know, there was this call for contributions for a book, and they were looking for blind people who write to submit articles for this book. And I thought, well, that's neat, you know. And I looked in a little bit more, and they really wanted fiction, and they wanted fiction based written by blind people, but it didn't have to be, you know, sort of one of these tell-all type. You know what, this New York Times author, he's a blind journalist. He works for the New York Times, and he calls it disability porn, where it's all, you know, it's just about people opening up their life and saying, look how hard it's been for me, you know, feel sorry for me. And aren't I wonderful and inspirational? You know, some people find that a little tiring. And they were looking for not that type of story. They were looking for stories that were fictional accounts. That involved, you know, people writing as good writers do. And I'm not saying I'm a good writer, but you write from about what you know. But it doesn't have to make you a superhero. It doesn't have to make you an inspirational character. So the stories are pretty interesting. You know, a lot of the characters in these stories you're going to say, oh, I don't really relate, or I don't like that person in that. But that's okay, right? That's what fictional stories are all about. You don't have to like the characters. They're just interesting stories.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Lawrence, you have provided us with an audio snippet here from your story, Getting Back Alive. Let's roll it.
It was a typical February morning when I set off for a day of ice fishing for walleye with a couple of guys I met over Facebook. The fishing was good. The company, not so much. No angler, blind or not, should ever have to go through what I experienced. The first rule of ice fishing is never trust the ice. It's especially true when fishing on rivers that are, at best, only partially frozen. Hooking up with other anglers is normal because of our unwritten code to always pair up. Unlike the ice, however, a guy should be able to trust his fishing buddies. Judging by their text messages, the two guys I planned a day of ice fishing with seemed all right. Neither had a vehicle of their own and were happy to take me up on my offer to use my truck. I explained I was a blind angler, as sometimes this can be a deal breaker. It's the sort of information I never like to spring on someone at the last minute. But for some reason, these two guys never quite seemed to have grasped the concept of blind.
Lawrence, you are a great storyteller. You're a great host of podcasts and radio shows, TV shows. We've done documentaries together. What was it like doing some writing?
Well, Dave, I'm also an angler, right? And you know us, we do have a way of stretching the truth in everything I write. No, I, you know, when I'm as an angler, we like to have fun. We like to brag a bit. You know, we like to expand on the day of how great it was or how horrible it was or why you shouldn't go there because there's absolutely no fish at that lake. But I wrote this story and I was just, I had some inspiration. I was out fishing one day with, you know, some friends and some things happened. I thought, and I was just writing down, making some notes. I was going to turn it into just a post, right, for my blog. And I thought, well, no, maybe I should expand this and make it a little more, make it funny. Like it's just a funny fictional kind of account. And I wrote it and I showed it to my wife and she wrote it. She read it. And she goes, I said, so what do you think? Is it? She goes, this is horrific. I go, it's not funny then. She goes, it's horrific. Who are these people? So I never did anything with it. I said, oh, I can't post that. I got to have this kind of reaction, right? People are going to say, oh my God, did this really happen to you? So I just parked it. And then when I saw this call for articles, I submitted it. And then they came back to me and said, hey, yeah, we like this and we'll work with you with an editor. And they did. They signed a really quality editor, like, you know, like a newsroom. Mm-hmm. And I started getting back all these edit suggestions and, you know, fix this, change that, blah, blah, blah. And went through three or four. And every time they did it, Dave, I added 200 more words.
Oh, editor's best friend right there. Hey, Lawrence, listen.
Oh, yeah, like,
listen, man, we're a little tight for time here, so I got to ask you before we get out. So, what's coming up on the next episode of Outdoors?
You know what? Whistler had the Olympics, the Winter Olympics out there. Because of the Paralympics, they made some really cool, accessible, you know, outdoor opportunities out in Whistler Mountain area. So we're talking with one of the advocacy and organizations that provide outdoor opportunities 4 seasons a year for people with disabilities in the Whistler area in British Columbia. And what that all means. Oh, great, great options. And I want to move there. Anyway, it's all going to be in the podcast show coming out Sunday.
You and me both, buddy. I want to get out there too. Let's buy a condo together. That's Lawrence Gunther. Have a great day, buddy. You've been listening to Now with Dave Brown. Hit the subscribe button on any podcast platform and leave us a rating and a review.